And welcome to this episode of Not a Lady, a Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman podcast. My name is Sarah.
And this is Kelly.
And this is episode 12 of season 1, titled Happy Birthday. It's February right now. And just a flashback, Dr. Mike was born on February 15th, 1833, which means that this month, she's technically celebrating her 188th birthday.
Wow.
In 2021. But I just have a question. Isn't there snow in Colorado in February?
That's a good point.
This is something I thought about way too much when watching this episode.
Maybe February, I guess it depends, because we've seen them have that snowstorm, and that was around Christmas time of last year.
Right.
So they do have snow, so
if this is her first birthday out west, then she's probably only been in Colorado like half a year.
Or they just didn't show her birthday last year. I don't know. Yeah, this is a little debatable. It probably is her first birthday.
No, I think it is because that's why her mom sends her the package.
Right.
But we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. Let's talk about lessons from The Prisoner.
Let's.
Do you want to go first? Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, no, I'll go. We had a really funny comment from TV_junk13 on Instagram, who said, "Those soldiers are dumb. How obvious was Michaela when she freed Cloud Dancing?"
I learned that the soldiers are dumb, which I think we mentioned that. Like, she was.
Yeah.
She should not quit her job to become an actress.
Right.
On Instagram, Gilmore Forever said, "A lesson Dr. Mike learned was that she could not rely on the Reverend. He was not strong enough morally to challenge the general or fight for the Indians. She was very disappointed for that."
Right. And we talked about that.
Do you agree that he's not reliable, though? That she can't rely on him?
I don't know. Well, and then it's kind of like, does it matter? Does Dr. Mike is so strong-willed anyway that she doesn't need to rely on someone for what she thinks is morally right or wrong, and we saw that in this episode. But I do think, I mean, I asked the question of, like, why is she asking him in the first place, but I do think she's disappointed because she wants someone to be able to be bold and stand up with her, and I think the reality is that he is not quite ready to commit to that. So, yeah, I think I agree in a sense.
But in a way, he does kind of come around and, like, rally with her in the end. Mind you, he doesn't actually
do anything
other than keep watch, I guess.
Occupy. Yeah.
But I think what's hard with the Reverend is, like, she knows that he doesn't agree with Custer. The question is, does he feel it's his responsibility as the minister to do something about it? And I think maybe that's what Dr. Mike was, like, waiting for him to get it on board for her to do something. And maybe kind of what you're saying, she needs to realize she doesn't need other people to tell her to do the right thing, right? Like, right. If she knows it's the right thing, she should just do it. But I feel like that's not necessarily something she learned, because we've seen her do that before. I'm, like, thinking of, like, Bad Water, where everyone's like, don't go to the thing. And she's like, I'm going, with or without you.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it is interesting. The Reverend made for an interesting dynamic in that episode. And I liked that we were able to talk about, where is the power in this town? It's so different than our modern view of, like, law and order and justice or whatever.
Our faithful listener Petulis said, "I think the biggest lesson for me is that one or two people can actually make a difference. Sully and Mike couldn't save all the Cheyenne Indians, but they were able to save Cloud Dancing."
I love that.
100% true.
I think there are so many people who are like, well, if I can't do everything to solve the bigger problem, then I shouldn't do anything at all. Whereas if you have the power to change the world for one person, that is just as important. That has value. I really like that lesson too. Petulis also added that she learned, as a listener, what a hurdy-gurdy is. So I'm gonna high-five myself for History! Yeah!
Zoom high five. Zoom high five. Ta-da! Ready? Oh, where's my camera?
You can have the little... Isn't there a little, like, high five emoji?
Oh, yeah, there's
a little... Oh, no, thing. Just a thumbs I up. Never thumbs up, bro. Yay for history. I was going to say something along the lines of, one day you're going to teach me something about doctoring from this show, and I'm going to save someone's life. But then I realized that I don't actually want to be in the position where I have to save someone's life. There's a reason I did not go to medical school.
I was thinking about that the other day. I mean, not that I'm traveling anywhere, but I was like, if I got on a plane right now and, you know, they did the whole, like, there's any medical staff on board or, like, any doctor on board. And, like, sure, I would go to the front, but I'd be terrified because I feel like I know things, but I don't really know things. But, actually, Petula, it makes me think of that thing that she said that I think about that a lot. Like, yeah, I can't save every patient or change every life, but you can help one person and they can help other people and who knows what they'll go on to do. But who knows, Sarah? You never know. You might be delivering a baby for someone in the middle of... the tropics. I don't know.
Oh my gosh. No.
That's kind of my dream, actually. Thanks for writing lessons in, guys. Or do you have
no,
more?
No, that's it. Oh, there's a non-lesson thing. We did get an email from Julie. And Julie wrote in a lot of things. But at the end of her email said, a cameo from Benji. Is he named in honor of the movie dog? Or just a coincidence? And so Benji is my beautiful little rescue dog who is right under my chair right now as we are recording, as he is almost every time unless I kick him out of the room. But usually if I kick him out of the room, he stays out for like half an hour and then he starts scratching at the door, so I have to let him in. But yes, Benji is named after Joe Camp's famous movie Benji, movies that came out long before I was born. So when I got my little Benji, he's a little mutt, but I still have my mom's Benji stuffed animal that she had when she was young. And when I ended up adopting Benji, he kind of picked his own name because he went and he laid down next to this stuffed animal of Benji. And I took a picture, so I have the picture, and I decided that he had picked his own name and he had to be a Benji. And so he's my boy. And everyone loves him in the family. And do you know there's a scene coming up where they talk about a certain character liking his horse more than he likes any person? That is me with my dog.
I can confirm.
But anyway, no spoilers. So, okay, let's talk about the episode.
Let's.
Season 1, Episode 12, titled Happy Birthday, aired on the 27th of March, 1993. It was directed by Chuck Bowman. This is his fifth of 32 directorial runs on Dr. Quinn. The last episode that we would have seen that he directed was The Prisoner. And the writers for this episode, Tony Perling is back. The last episode that Tony wrote that we talked about would have been The Great American Medicine Show. And of course, Beth Sullivan gets creator credit. I do want to mention, before we jump in any further, in the Dr. Quinn logical viewing order, this episode is two episodes after Bad Water and right after Running Ghost, which I find super interesting, especially given in the last episode, when we were talking about Running Ghost lessons, there was a mention of, like, Bad Water and Running Ghost kind of being parallel perspectives on the romance story, being that maybe Bad Water was about Sully, you know, starting to have feelings for Dr. Mike, and Running Ghost being Dr. Mike starting to have feelings for Sully. So I find it really interesting that in the logical viewing order, those two would be back-to-back right before this one, which I think many would argue is another, as far as their love story being, you know, a romantic timeline. It's really interesting to have this one be the one that comes right after both of those. This episode opens in the homestead where Dr. Mike seems to be looking through what I would assume is some sort of catalog, like mail order catalog for items that probably can't be bought just in Bray's Mercantile. Right. Brian points at something and says, can I have one of those? And Colleen's like, you don't even know what that is. It turns out it's a corset.
Right.
It's funny in the moment, but part of me is like,
what did he think?
Actually think it was? Right.
Yeah.
So I did a little bit of reading about the corset just for the fun of it, because that's the kind of person that I am. I thought maybe he thought it was, so there is some corsetry crossover between the adaptation of body armor and the evolution of corsets through history. And I was like,
would not have guessed that.
Just from the drawing, maybe he thought it was something cool like that. That would be my guess. But one thing that I just want to mention about corsets, I think the most iconic scene of all time that has to do with corsets is from the first Pirates of the Caribbean, where the pirates are fighting towards the end, and the one pirate is about to kill Orlando Bloom's character, Will Turner. And he's like, I'm gonna make you feel so much pain. And then Keira Knightley's character, Elizabeth Swann, like whacks the pirate in the face. And she goes, you like pain? Try wearing a corset.
I haven't watched that movie enough to remember that.
But interestingly, I have linked the blog post on our website. I found this entire historical breakdown of the corset through the years, from what it was made of to how it evolved through styles and fashion and resources. And two things that I just want to point out is that in the Middle Ages and in the 18th century, the corset was worn more for comfort than fashion.
How is that possible?
Well, you'll find that there are seasons where it's all about fashion, you know, tiny waist or making, you know, your bust look bigger or your hips look wider, you know. Similar to finding support for posture or for other undergarment support, the corset in certain seasons of history has provided that. Some of it has to do with the amount of layers that used to be worn and the weight of the fabrics and the heaviness of dresses in the olden days. Sometimes women actually needed that extra support for the spine, for the shoulders, to actually be able to kind of bear the weight of all their clothing.
Glad we don't do that now.
Well, actually, when I was reading some of these articles, apparently the corset's making a comeback, but I don't know that it ever totally went away if we want to talk about Spanx.
Right, that's true. There's different versions of it today, I'm sure, but...
Yeah. The scene progresses, and Matthew comes in with a big package that is from Dr. Mike's mom. She is reading the letter, and it kind of backtracks on their relationship a little bit, because it seems like Michaela's mom is definitely still a little resentful that her daughter has chosen to remain in the bush away from, it's just the words that she uses, right? Civilization, and since your status as an unmarried woman is not going to change. If you just think about that sentence, that is like super, it's like meant to be degrading. Dr. Mike tries to laugh it off, but her mother has sent some Wedgwood china, which I was like, what is Wedgwood china? I don't even know.
I'm sure a lot of people don't know what that, I don't even know what that is.
Well, I'm about to tell you. Wedgwood china was invented in 1759 in England by Josiah Wedgwood, who is historically known as the father of English potters. And he served Queen Charlotte, wife of King George III. He manufactured all her china. And so another title of his was Her Majesty's Potter.
So it's nice stuff that obviously had to be shipped, yeah.
I think the fact that it comes from England also sets it up as being this, like, more refined taste.
Right. Which I guess is all the more unfortunate because the way that they find it is broken.
Apparently it's from her hope chest.
Which
is, like, a big deal because... Hope chest, what do you think about? What were you hoping for? A husband, dummy. So Kelly and I actually both have hope chests, which is very cool. Our mom, for, I think it was it for your 16th birthday? It was for my 17th birthday. We got a hope chest.
Yeah. Not that it had anything in it to, like, make us I mean, it's not used in the same way. People are going to come for us. Do you realize that? They're going to be like, your parents were expecting you to get married at 16 and 17 years old?
No, what I was going to say is, tell me what you have in your hope chest right now, because I'll tell you, I bet you mine's more embarrassing.
Blankets and stuffed animals.
Oh, wow, we're sisters. Guess what's in mine? Blankets and stuffed animals.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuffed animals that I, as a, you know, almost 30-year-old, can't bring myself to get rid of.
Part with. Yes. I love my hope chest. That is funny that you said that.
The idea of the hope chest originated in 15th century Italy, which is like Renaissance era. And the idea of it was that mothers of daughters would give their daughters a hope chest, and then they would keep things to help prepare, like, essential things to help them prepare for someday keeping house. And so I don't think it always has to be attached to a woman getting married, but I think oftentimes it was, because a woman gets her first house back in the day when she marries and leaves her parents' house. But interestingly enough, it was called a trousseau until the mid-20th century. It's not until 1933 that we're gonna hear the word hope chest. So this is actually a little bit of inaccurate wording for Dr. Quinn, because they call it a hope chest, but it wasn't until the 1930s that the title hope chest actually came out. Before that, it was called a trousseau, which it makes sense, because I think if they had used trousseau in the show, everyone would have been like, I don't know what that is.
Which, by the way, that's a French word that literally means, it's for a bride, like a bundle of items she'll take with her to her.
Oh.
Yeah. So that's funny you cool. said that. Yeah.
Look at that. We like came up with info together. How cool. That's awesome. You know, that makes sense that it's French too.
Right.
Okay.
So this upsets Dr. Mike. Her china's broken. Her mother has said some not the most encouraging things. So she actually goes outside and Brian follows her and, you know, says, Why are you crying? Are you crying because, like, your china's broken? And more or less what she says is, no, just sometimes I'm lonely. Again, it's not about the china necessarily. It's not about her birthday necessarily. It's just not about what her mom said. It's this combination of all these things making her feel old, alone, not wanted. And so she says,
probably a little homesick.
Yeah.
It seemed like she was really excited to get them.
Yeah.
And use yeah. them with the family.
Right. But he says, how could you feel lonely? You got us. And then they have a very cute little embrace. And I like it because earlier in that scene, she actually says, you know, I don't need anything. I have everything I need right here. And it's kind of a reminder of that sentiment, even though sometimes you can get lost in the other moments of your life that you may not be satisfied in.
I have a former professor who kind of like a mentor to me in college, and she never married. And I remember asking her one time, like, do you ever feel sad that you didn't get married? And she'd been engaged like a couple times, and she was like, maybe about once a month I feel right. sad that I didn't get married, you know? And so I think we all have those moments maybe where we're like, I'm actually totally content with this thing in my life right now, and then we'll have a day where it's like, you know what, today's a day where I'm not, and that's okay.
It is okay. Yeah. And I think it's a lot of different things for a lot of different people, not necessarily marriage in this case, like it is for Dr. Mike.
Definitely not.
Yeah. We have a transition. We are in the clinic now with Mr. Barton, who's not a character. Oh, what were you gonna
then,
say?
Then the intro plays.
Of course. How could
with
I forget
no
to
no narration.
That's what everybody came to this podcast for, to hear that part right there. They know they can count on it. But she's with Mr. Barton, and he has a cut on his neck. I'm in a medical ethics course in PA school right now, and we've learned a lot about how, like, you're never supposed to say to a patient, like, what took you so long to come in? Or judge them about the fact that, why did they not ask for help sooner? So she kind of makes him feel bad, where she's like, what took you so long? And he says that he asked Jake first, but Jake said it was nothing. And so basically he has a cut on his neck that happened from getting a shave from Jake. And now it's become infected, in which Dr. Mike says it is septicemia. And you are getting very excited. And I'm assuming that means you know what we're talking about.
I got so excited because I was like, I've learned things from Kelly and this podcast, because I know that sepsis has to do with infection, and it has to do with bacteria getting into wounds. And so I understood what she was telling him was wrong with him, which that has never happened before.
Yay!
Ever.
No, but I actually get excited when rewatching this because I forgot that we had talked about sepsis so much, but let's just be honest, that's like a huge reason that people were dying during this time period.
Well, this time period and every time period before it and many time periods after it.
And even now, sepsis. And so just so people understand, septicemia is technically what we've talked about before. It is, you know, you have bacteria on your skin, there's bacteria everywhere. When you have an open cut like that, bacteria has a direct access to your bloodstream, and now you're going to have what she says, you know, is also known as blood poisoning, which technically, I feel like it's not very commonly used today, right? At least when we're talking about medical jargon, but
that terminology.
Yeah, but now the infection is in your blood. I don't really like blood poisoning as much because that's actually where the idea, like, bloodletting came from, the fact that you have poison in your blood and we need to let it out. So I don't really like thinking of it like that, obviously. But I mean, septicemia and sepsis are used interchangeably a lot, but technically sepsis is the condition that now your body's immune response is like completely flared up. And that's why people have so many, you know, they have fever, they have necrosis, they have sweating, they have all these other effects that are not necessarily from the bacteria. It's from your body trying to fight the fact off that that bacteria is in your bloodstream, which is a really bad place for an infection to be. And so in this case, it's very plausible that yes, Jake did not properly sterilize or clean his, you know, his razor. And of course, sometimes when you're giving someone a very close shave, you can cut them. People do that now to themselves. And so if your razor's dirty and now you have this access to the bloodstream, it's not a good situation. So
the Cooper children are planning a surprise party for Dr. Mike because we kind of didn't mention.
Right.
She kind of hides the fact that the reason that her mother sent the dishes was because she's having her 35th birthday, which, by the way, means that if we know she was born February 15th, 1833, if it's her 35th birthday, we have confirmed year 1868.
Yeah.
So, to be honest, we know that a lot of the historical events and some of the people that I've talked about have been a little wobbly. I don't know that that's the right word, but that they play with time a little bit differently. We've had things that happened before that, happen after that, that they talk about. But this is nice to, like, get for the first time, like, our first official, like, this is meant to be February 1868.
No, that's a really good point. I didn't even think about having that opportunity to do the math, so this is true.
The Cooper kids decide the first person that they need to get on board for Dr. Mike's surprise party is Sully. And they find him at Robert E's where he's having, I guess it's some sort of knife sharpened. And it kind of like, it seems like it was going to be a really sweet thing. And then Brian just drops out there like, you know what you can do for us and for our ma's birthday? You can marry her and be our pa. Which is like the double whammy because it's like getting married and becoming a dad. Like, that's what you can do to help us celebrate this birthday.
It's not a big request. And it mostly made me laugh because they're like, Brian, you can't tell anyone about the surprise party. And then like 5 seconds later, he's like, we're having a surprise party. And also...
Yeah, he's trying to help. And we know how much he loves and admires Sully. The part where Brian says something along the lines of like, she's 35, she doesn't have much time left.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh gosh, what are they teaching children in school these days? If 35 is not much time left, then I'm in big trouble, man. Not that I'm there yet, but I'm close.
I took that as there's not a lot of time left to get married and have children, not as, like, there's not a lot of time left to live. Because I think, wouldn't you say, like...
Well, both are kind of insulting.
Oh, for sure. I mean, from a child, it's probably less severe, but, I mean, wouldn't you agree that, like, I would say people that are in today's world that are getting married past 35, that's probably more of, you know, an outlier to the norm, but that definitely probably was the case during this time period, right?
Yeah. I mean, traditionally, people got married much younger. I wouldn't say men, actually, though. Sometimes men would not get married till much later, but women definitely married much younger because, a lot of them didn't do anything else, right? Didn't have careers or go to college or, you know, and we're going to see, you know, this is a time where it's like starting to change. But, and even, yeah, even now there are people who get married very young, but 35 in the 1860s, yeah, you don't got much time left, I guess.
So Brian's not wrong. Yeah. Well, and, you know, you kind of wonder what response are we going to get from Sully. And he's like, well, I was thinking I was going to check my traps. I don't know if I'll be around, you know.
Which he only says after they make it
awkward. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Like, before he never says anything about it.
He kind of goes into panic mode.
Oh, I'm sure, you know. And then he, like, says very seriously, because Brian's pushing it again, like, don't you want to be our Paul? And he's like, what I am your friend. You have a paw. Like, he gets, like, real, like, serious, you know,
yeah.
and walks away.
Yeah. I don't mind that, because I think if you look at, because we've had this discussion, right? You and me have been like, do you think Sully's a father figure? And even when we've said, like, he's definitely, like, a male figure in their life, but he's not, it's not the same as... Mm-mm. A paw, but we notice how he shows up in their life more because they don't have a father figure in their everyday life. So I think I understand where Sully's like, wait a minute, I don't want you to identify me in this role that I have no responsibility to fill, right? I don't think it's even that he's doesn't want to be a dad or anything, but it's like, if you're placing me in this role, then that puts on a certain responsibility
right.
to me. And that ties into what Robert E., who's a nice friend and really doesn't say anything for most of the conversation, like, Robert E. is like, you have to understand Sully has been living a certain way for a very long time.
Yeah.
So to see anything outside of that, that's going to be really hard for him. And I think that's exactly what it is, right? It's not that he doesn't care about the Cooper kids. It's not that he doesn't care about Dr. Mike. But it's to be like, wait a minute, if you're going to place me in this box and say, here are the walls of this role now that you have to fulfill, especially when he's lived very, you know, to his own, for himself for a long time, it's scary.
No, I think anybody would have been uncomfortable in that situation, especially when you're put on the spot like that, and it does hold a lot of responsibility, even if it is only a child asking you.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But it's, I mean, it's dangerous too, like, even if he had just played it off because it was Brian, that's dangerous too, to, like, put any false or un... Because he says, you know, I can't make any promises, even that I'll be there, because it's dangerous to even get the kids' hopes up, right? He doesn't want to do that. It's a funny scene to watch, but there's definitely, like, some secondhand, like, oh, gosh, did you just... Brian, stop talking!
Definitely. At the clinic, Mr. Barton is not doing well. Dr. Mike makes a comment in which she says, you know, there's nothing I can do except keep him comfortable. Which, at first, I was like, how is this possible? Today, if you were septic, you're in the hospital, we would first admit you to the hospital, you'd be hospitalized, and then we would start aggressive IV antibiotics and fluids. And so I'm thinking about the antibiotics that I know that you can use for sepsis based on what the bacteria, and I'm like, wait, what about antibiotics? Then I remembered, the first antibiotic that ever was discovered was, do you know, actually, the first antibiotic ever discovered?
No.
Penicillin? Sound familiar?
Yeah.
Penicillin wasn't discovered until 1928.
Mm.
So we also have to talk about the fact that we don't really know a lot about infection at this point. To make a long story short, there's this guy named Ignaz Semmelweis, and he observed puerperal sepsis, which is basically sepsis after women give birth, and a lot of women were dying from it. And he started to think, why is this happening? What's going on with this? He noticed that midwives that were delivering babies, their rates of death after giving birth were not as high. He also had a colleague who did an autopsy and had cut himself, who died from sepsis as well. So he started figuring out, what are people doing different? And he realized it was a lot about hand washing practice. So he didn't start writing articles about this until the 1860s, which is the period that we're in right now for Dr. Quinn. There's also Louis Pasteur and Joseph Lister. You might know them from pasteurization or Listerine. Those are the guys that came up with that.
What?
Yep. These guys also formalized more theories about sepsis and about infection and how to maintain sterile practice in surgical procedures. But again, these articles that they were coming out with weren't coming out until 1867 or even later than that. And a lot of these ideas were highly mocked and seen as just like extremely progressive from the medical community. And so it was not something that was really believed, which is crazy now, right? Because we're like washing your hands, especially in today's day and age, is like one of the biggest things that every single person knows. But we didn't know that at this point. So the idea that, one, we don't have any antibiotics. So she's correct in saying that she can't really do much more for Mr. Barton because penicillin, like I said, 1928. And also the fact that at this point, he's already been infected, and the idea of sterility, hand washing, or whatever has not flourished into the...
It's not become a regular part of the culture, right, or a habit of medical professionals or anyone, really.
Exactly. And so we see Mr. Barton, unfortunately, start hallucinating. He's seeing his mother, and he ends up passing away in this scene with Dr. Mike, which is frustrating, we know. And of course, I think we all are assuming what's going to happen next. She's going to give Jake a piece of her mind because we know that this is what happened. Jake gave him a shave.
Well, she says, "I've warned him about his razors before," which right. We haven't really seen, but just from that line, we know that this is an issue she's had with him.
Yes. So Dr. Mike goes over to Jake's and she basically checks to see if his blade is disinfected, in which he is quite rude and blows on it and wipes it on his shoulder and says, "It's sterilized." And unfortunately, the way that this conversation goes, I think, is not great. And I'll ask your opinion on it. But she says, "My patient just died. Mr. Barton, maybe you know him. He died from a dirty razor. I've told you a million times. It's you that killed him."
Yeah.
Which, like, harsh, lady.
Well, part of me wants to just be like, we know that Dr. Mike takes losing patients hard.
And personal.
Yeah. And so the fact that she immediately goes to confront Jake, I think, is not a very wise decision for herself, like, emotionally. But I think the reason she does it is because, like you just pointed out, there was nothing she could do for Harry Barton. So she feels, again, helpless and decides the only thing she can do is make sure that Jake doesn't make the same mistake twice. Unfortunately, her way of doing that is
making him feel responsible and guilty.
Yeah, like this is the point of the whole episode, right? Like this line right here is a big driving behind everything that happens in this episode where she says you killed him. And part of me is like, I wish she had said your irresponsibility killed him, you know?
If you're gonna say something, then yeah.
He definitely contributed, but to just be like, it's the same as if you pulled the trigger on him yourself, like, that's really harsh. And she would feel so awful if someone said that to her, you know? Like, we know that. That's the point of this, right? So this is very intentional. She's, like, in the throes of her own emotions.
She is.
And she blasts Jake for right. it, and it's in front of his customers in the middle of the day, you know? It's like all of it is like
there would have been many other ways to go about it if you wanted to address it, but she doesn't do it in the best way. But as I think we were talking last episode about the fact that these characters are human, and sometimes we don't like to see that, but that's real life, right? So this storyline will continue for sure.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, if this ended here and that was how it went, then it would be like, wait, that doesn't make sense. But this is all part of the journey of this episode.
Right.
At the homestead, their Coopers and Dr. Mike are loading up the wagon, and the kids are all encouraging Dr. Mike that she needs to get out more and be social with people, men people.
I love that line.
And that if someone were to ask to court her, that she would maybe possibly say yes. It's a little hard to hear Brian be like, if we had a paw, then we would be a real family.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a little bit unfair, especially considering we know
they haven't had one for a while.
Yeah. But I think maybe that's why it feels more important to Brian, knowing that he's lost so much, that he's like, maybe I won't feel as... Because, you know, these are kids who surely with good reason, are still grieving the loss of a mother and a father, because let's not forget the way that their dad left this last time was pretty traumatizing.
Yeah, whether they knew the truth or not, yeah.
Yeah, no, just the whole, yeah, him being back and making all these promises and then leaving, even though they don't know, yeah, the whole circumstances of his leaving, that's still really hard. But I realize it's not that they see Dr. Mike as less of a person because she's not married. What they see is she told them she's lonely. She just cried over these things from home, and her birthday's coming up, and so their mindset is, this is a person we love and we want to be happy. Maybe this will be the way. And especially with the letters, that this is not the first letter that Michaela's got from her mother that has upset her in this way.
Right.
And so I have to get out of my head there being like, you need to get married because that's what will make you happy. They're kids, so they're like, okay, how can we help? Like, and so I think it's one of those things where when I process it from a positive point of view and not from my 2021 perspective of, this is,
you don't need no man.
Well, not, yeah, that, but also just, you know, that people who are single must be missing out on something.
Right.
Yeah. It is
from a good place.
It is.
Yeah. Unfortunately, at the saloon, Jake is drowning his woes with a little bit of alcohol. Not a little bit, a lot. And Lauren and Hank are there, you know, telling him it's not your fault. Like, he must have shared the whole situation, and they're saying, it's not your fault.
Well, Lauren was there.
Oh, that's true. He was sitting there awkwardly with his newspaper. But Jank? Who's Jank? Jank is angry Jank.
It's their ship name.
No. I wasn't even thinking that. I was thinking it was like angry Jake is Jank, but that makes more sense. Hank and Jake together is Jank. Who's on Team Jank? Not me, because basically Hank tries to cut him off and Jake is not having it. In fact, Jake tries to take Myra to the back, in which Hank definitely isn't going to stand for.
They're both nasty in this scene. And at first you think Hank is trying to be a good friend. Well, Lauren is really trying to be a good friend. I'll let you shave me. Like, and I think Hank, in his Hank way too, is. But then when the Myra thing happens and he's like, don't be manhandling the merchandise. And I'm like, why? I hate you. And sometimes there are these scenes that make me forget how much I don't like you. Right. But in this moment, I'm like, oh.
I think, like you said, in his own way, because he's trying to cut him off, he ends up actually dragging him out of the saloon.
Yeah.
And then we have this kind of sad sentiment from Jake, which is the fact that he says, I don't need any of you. Which we will see how this plays into his life and his healing.
If you flash back to the episode, The Visitor, that's the episode where Robert E. gets injured. Jake was drinking in that episode as well after Dr. Mike chewed him out for not wanting Robert E. to go into a shop to get medical care. And so I think in that episode, I can't quite remember what I said, but I was like, we need to put a pin in this and recognize when Jake is feeling guilty about something, Jake becomes an alcoholic.
Right.
Or I guess he's always an alcoholic, but it
is heightened in his states of, yes.
In the mercantile, Brian.
Choosing candy because he has a sweet tooth. Relatable.
Relatable. Colleen is looking for a book on how to find a husband for Dr. Mike. Which, it's kind of funny, Grace, who is also a single woman, decides to help her find a book. And the title of the book is On Matters of Matrimony, which, of course, I looked up to see if it was a real book.
Of course. I was counting on you doing it.
However, because they have the narration that will be Colleen reading the book, I think it was just created for this particular episode. That being said, I found a blog. The title of the blog is How to Get Married in the 1860s and Early 1870s. And they pulled an excerpt from a British book. It's called Castle's Household Guide. And it was published in 1869. And it has an entire segment on matrimonial engagements, settlements, wedding planning and all that kind of thing. And I was reading through the excerpt from this book, and it definitely seems very in line with the fictional book that they have in Dr. Quinn. And it was just really funny to read. So if you want to check out that excerpt, it's on our website. But I'm like, wow, people in the 19th century, like, they make it seem like romance and marriage is down to a structure and a science. I think there are some days in my life where I'm like, maybe I need to get down to the science of matchmaking.
I think some people make their living off of that idea, so you're not wrong.
You know, you're probably right. I don't really need to know. I mean, that's what eHarmony is now, right? Like, they're like, just put in your info, we'll do the hard part.
We need to make Dr. Mike a eHarmony account.
I mean, if you really wanted to think about it, that's kind of what this episode is.
Yeah, no, for sure. And of course, this starts a conversation about Dr. Mike's birthday party, and Emily overhears, and she's all for it. But Hank actually overhears as well, even though he doesn't comment or anything. I think we'll see that play out later in the episode. But Brian, cute little Brian, starts staring at Lauren. We're wondering why. And he says,
you like my mom.
Like, you think she's pretty? She did save your life. Like, would you court her? In which Lauren responds, like, get out of here, literally. Like,
which you kind of wish that Sully was in there so that he wouldn't feel so awkward about it, because basically Brian's asking everyone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But it is funny because Hank's laughing and, you know, Lauren's like, wipe that smirk off your face.
Yeah, he's teasing Lauren. Did you notice that Emily's idea for a birthday gift for Dr. Mike was a fancy cookbook?
Oh, yeah. And Grace makes a face and you're like, yeah. I'd be like, if I got you a cookbook for Christmas.
I would probably panic.
I'd be like, what are you trying to say?
I'll be like, oh, what a wonderful, beautiful paperweight.
Gosh. But it's Sunday morning, and speaking of asking everyone they can, Matthew this time pulls the Reverend aside and asks if he will court Dr. Mike, in which I appreciate the Reverend having a very realistic and ethical answer, in which, you know, we have a professional relationship, we work together sometimes, I don't want to ever make things awkward.
Why do you feel like that's an ethical?
I think it's because I'm in medical ethics right now, and we talk a lot about, like, patients dating doctors, and I literally just had to write, like, a discussion post about why that's wrong. And so I think anybody would agree that if you have to have a working professional relationship with someone, it's probably a horrible idea to try and date them. But also, the Reverend's just a smart guy, and he's the only one that thought of that first.
But that, doesn't that undo every medical drama?
Okay, well, that's my point.
You know, but what's kind of interesting to me is, like, I think of all the people they've asked, other than us being, like, obviously Sully, actually, the Reverend kind of makes sense. Yeah. Like, he's a nice guy.
He's a nice, honest, kind.
He's handsome. He cares about helping people. Like, they have very similar, you know.
No spoilers, but it's not the last time we'll see this idea come up. That's for sure. Yes.
Dr. Mike sees Emily and Grace, two people who she considers friends, whispering behind her back. And she goes full middle school girl mode and is like, they must be gossiping about me. Which I'm like, girl, why are you jumping to that conclusion? But I guess it's probably to do with the fact that she's just feeling, this is probably just an overly emotional week for Dr. Mike. Between the package from her mother, her birthday's coming up, she just lost a patient to something that technically
was preventable.
Yeah.
I think I do this sometimes too, right? If you're insecure about something, and then anytime you're insecure about something, anything outside of that, you're going to assume that people are talking about, right? Like, I think she's feeling insecure about the fact that she knows she's a quote-unquote old maid, right? So the fact that people are whispering, she's assuming she knows what they're talking about.
Speaking of old maid was originated the first time in text in 1761, and it was a title of a play by Irishman Arthur Murphy. But for a long season, old maid actually referred to an unpopped kernel of popcorn.
Which, so that's what she is, an unpopped kernel? What does that even mean? Okay.
Right. Which is how I'm like, huh. I wonder what the metaphorical correspondence to an unmarried woman of who's old.
Right.
And then, of course, it's a children's game as well. Old Maid is just a game.
It's a card game.
Which, of course, leads us into the laugh where she chews out Colleen for gossiping, which is not what she was doing. Which I'm like, why are you chewing out the 13-year-old? You know, like, could talk to your friends and ask them. But, of course, she doesn't want to do that. Because, like you said, she's feeling insecure. And she's like, I don't need people discussing that I'm an old maid. No one said you're an old maid. And Brian goes, yeah, no one said anything about the maid part.
Yeah, it's too funny. He has so many lines that's like, you're only getting away with it because you're a really cute child.
And then that's when, I guess, the Reverend changes his mind.
He changed his mind. He gave the sermon. He realized it's not such a bad idea. And he comes and asks Dr. Mike if she'll go on a buggy ride with him, which, you know, is the equivalent of going on a date, right? And of course she says, no, I promised the children that we'll go on a picnic, but who shows up out of nowhere? Your favorite.
Oh, he definitely wasn't in the church dressed like that.
No, but like literally as soon as she says like, I promise the children, he's like, I'll take them.
Except he doesn't look too happy about letting her go.
Yeah, but he's letting her. And she does. She goes on this buggy ride. And actually, when they're riding, I'm like, they look nice together. Like, they look good together. But then I get uncomfortable.
To be honest, I think this is the weakest scene in the entire episode. Because they already had Colleen, like, narrating from the book. You need someone of moral character, which then leads into them asking the Reverend. And then you have Colleen reading, like, oh, differences in opinion need to be figured out very soon. And then the first thing that they show the Reverend asking is, like, how do you feel about children? Which just doesn't make sense. Like, he would not say that. I just don't like the writing in this scene. Because, obviously, she adopted 3 children that were not her own. Like, that's silly.
Good point.
And, listen, I don't have a problem with him having planned out what he wants to do. Like, there are people, I had friends who were like, I know what I want. Like, when I meet the person, I'm gonna get married, I want to have kids, I want to be a wife and a mother. I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to have a plan. I think it's dangerous because, hello, life, nothing ever goes the way we plan. My life, it's always like, okay, I make a plan, God laughs, and then goes, let me change this all up for you. But the whole point of Colleen's narrating was differences of opinion. And they don't actually show them disagreeing about anything. They just show her feeling uncomfortable when he's like, when I get married, short engagement, have kids.
Let me go forth and multiply. And then I'm like, why are you talking about this? You didn't even want to go on this date like an hour ago.
Yeah.
I think that's the problem that bothered me. It wasn't that he didn't want to go, but he acted like it was such just like, crazy idea. And then all of a sudden he, I don't know. I mean, if that happened to me today, like if a guy was like.
And that's what I mean about this scene being weak.
Yeah, I understand that.
It just doesn't quite work. It would have been nice to like see what made him come around. I think it could have made sense for them actually to have a disagreement. I mean, we just saw in the last episode in The Prisoner, they definitely had. And in the end, they came out, quote unquote, on the same team. But they still argued about what the best way to go about it was, you know? I don't know. The narration of, like, what they were trying to show, why they weren't a good pair, didn't actually work in the dialogue that happened in the scene.
I agree. And as much as I'm like, that's crazy, if someone did that to me on a first date, I'd be like, LOL, what?
But 1800s.
Exactly. I suppose it's a bit more appropriate. And I will say that I think a lot of Christian-minded people are more focused on certain things in a certain aspect, so I can see how the Reverend was that way, especially during this time period, but I literally did write LOL what in my notes.
I have linked on our website a page, the title of it is A Brief History of Courtship and Matchmaking in America, and it talks about some of those logistics through the ages of, like, how long was a couple expected to court with a chaperone, and then progressing to once they are engaged, then they can participate in holding hands or walking together beside each other on the street. And so it was funny to see that and see how maybe the Reverend is, yeah, coming from like, okay, this is my role. This is what's expected of me. If I'm going to do this, boom.
Here's where I'm at, and I'm going to let you know. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
The next day, Sully is in the mercantile looking at a dress. We wonder, is he thinking about buying it for Dr. Mike? Because he kind of looks at the price. And then Lauren comes up, which I'm like, is this the first time we've ever seen Lauren approach Sully to talk to him? Usually it's like the other way around. But Lauren's just like,
what you gawking at?
And then Sully walks out. And I like the misdirect here that we think he's gonna do this over-the-top thing related to her. Because I like that it subverts our expectations for later in the episode. Who actually ends up getting the makeover? You know, in Grease, where at the end she like stops being herself and he wears the Letterman jacket for like 2 minutes of screen time and then takes it off and then is back in his all black T-Birds attire and you're like, so the only person who changed was the woman. But I like the subverted expectation. We were thinking, oh, Sully.
Yeah.
And then as he's leaving the mercantile, he bumps into her. And I kind of wish they hadn't made him be a little bit petty. Because he's like, how was your buggy ride? And she says, oh, it was nice. Thanks for asking. Thanks for taking care of the kids.
And then there's like an awkward silence. And it's like they like need to keep talking to each other. Because then she's like, oh, Brian's puppy has a new trick. You should come over. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, they're so close, but sometimes they have these like awkward conversations, which I guess is that's real. That's normal. But
well, so I was thinking about this. If this episode is meant to come directly after Badwater, then Running Ghost, they've gone through two pretty intense experiences together.
Mm-hmm.
They've recognized that they both care for each other far more than either one of them anticipated or planned for. And so I have to wonder if in that moment where she starts talking about Brian, it's a safe place because it prevents them from having to talk about themselves and where they're at.
Probably, you're probably right.
Didn't you? You brought up once, like, a defense mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
If we talk about anything other than ourselves, it's safe. And that's the thing. They've been through these pretty intense, traumatizing experiences together. They've grown to care about each other. They've saved each other's lives. So where do we go next? Let's not talk about where we go next. Let's talk about Brian.
I think you're right. I think you are right. But the conversation is interrupted because Myra comes running over and she says that Jake is not answering his door. And Lauren says he's on a binge. Leave him alone. This is what he does. But they all run over the shop and they all can see him passed out on the floor. So Sully breaks the glass. They get inside and we have one of those things that kind of bothers me where Dr. Mike like looks at someone and like touches their pulse and suddenly knows exactly what's going on internally.
I think you're wearing off on me because I was like, how do you know that he has alcohol poisoning? All you did was touch his pulse. Basically, what you can say is he's alive, which she does say.
She does, yeah. Which I understand, like, one thing, medical school, PA school, whatever, that's one of the first things you do. You build this differential diagnosis in your head of what you think's going on. Of course, that's probably the first thing on her list, alcohol poisoning. But I don't know, the way she says things so definitively, sometimes I'm like, all right, girl. I don't know about that, but anyway, alcohol poisoning, I think people are familiar with the idea, but we know that alcohol is absorbed very quickly, faster than food. And so it takes the body a lot of time to metabolize it and process it correctly. And what mostly does that is the liver, which she'll talk about in a second. But it is true that when people are going through alcohol poisoning, they're going to experience confusion, vomiting, seizures. It's going to slow your breathing. It's going to take down your internal body temperature. And that's because alcohol is a depressant. It's going to depress and lower everything. And so it can affect your gag reflex, which is why it's really important for people to make sure you position them properly, especially if they're passed out and they're vomiting, because a lot of people can choke on their own vomit. She mentions that she's going to need to pump his stomach, which they actually never show any of that happening, but the reality is that he is jaundice, and he probably has a damaged liver. As I said before, your body...
What's jaundice?
So jaundice is when, like I said, we were talking about how the body has to metabolize all that alcohol. Yeah. Well, the liver does that, and right next to the liver is the gallbladder. So sometimes what happens is it has to do that so quickly and there's so much alcohol that you can actually have an obstruction of the bile duct. And the bile duct is a combination of the cystic duct from the gallbladder and the hepatic duct from the liver. They come together and form the bile duct. Well, bile gets backed up because the liver's trying to do what it needs to do. So that causes an increase in bilirubin. Bilirubin is yellow. Sorry, I know this is probably a little too complicated. And so when that happens, it actually starts pigmenting your skin yellow because all that bilirubin is backed up and it can't be properly metabolized. And so he didn't actually look jaundiced in the film, but if you ever see someone with jaundice, you'll 100% know. It happens a lot of people with liver failure. Their skin color, like their eyes, the whites of their eyes become very yellow, and it's called jaundice. And so that's why people can actually die from drinking, because it's too much for your body to have
to
do.
Isn't that what Lauren says, like, in the next scene? Don't tell me you can die from drinking. And I'm like, surely people have died from drinking all throughout history.
Right. And so they take him to the clinic, and she mentions that he's going to go through withdrawal, and he's going to have something called delirium tremens, which is...
Can you get... So, sorry. He binged all that time. Is his withdrawal... I guess I was thinking, like, when you say withdrawal, I think of, like, an addict. But maybe this isn't necessarily, like, an addict withdrawal. This is, like, that binge could have overwhelmed his body.
So I think you're correct, because delirium tremens, which is basically just this rapid onset of confusion caused by your body withdrawing from alcohol, for that to happen, it usually is from someone having a high alcohol intake for more than a month. So the reality of this situation, I don't know what Jake's normal drinking habits are. For all I know, he could drink a six pack every night. I don't know. Okay. But normally, yes, it's more of a severe thing that your body is so dependent on the alcohol because it's a daily thing, right? You're not just going on a binge. So I don't think that's the most realistic thing in the world. I will definitely agree with you on that. But usually, it's going to take about 3 days for you to start having those withdrawal symptoms, and it's going to last for probably 2 to 3 days as well. So I think that the acting, they do a good job with him shaking, shivering, sweating, hallucinations. That's all real. That's 100% real. I've seen that in real life. That's exactly probably what somebody would be going through. Whether it's realistic for this case or not, I don't know.
Very impressive performance from Jim Knobloch. It's super realistic, and you feel for Jake, and you see the struggle, and even Lauren
is really concerned.
Yeah, and Sully offering to stay, and they're, like, holding him down, and he's freaking out. It's terrifying.
No, absolutely. And, I mean, today, you would admit that person to the hospital, you would probably give them benzos, which are sedatives, but again, those didn't come out till 1955. Diazepam, lorazepam, I know we have some medical people, so though... You know, Halidol, that's an anti-hallucination. That stuff didn't come out till actually pretty recently. So she does mention that she's going to give him a sedative. I would really like to know what that is. Part of me thinks it's probably laudanum, which is a painkiller and a sedative. However...
Super addictive.
Yes.
We haven't had a lot of laudanum talk yet.
But I think we've talked about opium tincture before, which everybody knows that opioids are very addictive. So yeah,
actually... Laudanum and morphine. I know, those are two things that are not good for people, that they used a lot back then.
And what's funny now is, like, laudanum is used today mostly to ease withdrawal in infants born to, like, mothers who are addicted to opioids or heroin or something like that. And it's very dangerous to mix opioids with alcohol because they're both depressants. They both depress the body's system. So in this case, I'm, like, really hoping she's not giving laudanum, but I think that was probably one of the main things that was around during this time, so yeah. It's sad to see Jake go through a lot of these hallucinations because he's calling out Harry's name, he's telling Harry he's sorry, and you're realizing he has so much guilt built up. Whether that's from Dr. Mike, I mean, I'm sure a huge part of it is from the way that she made him feel, but he probably just internally has a lot of guilt. And so it's difficult to see him go through that. And then he even goes through this phase where he's telling Dr. Mike he loves her and she's the most beautiful thing he's ever seen.
Do you think that's a hallucination or do you think that's his innermost thoughts coming out?
That's what people say about alcohol, right? Like, your most honest self comes out.
Well, that's what I was wondering. I was like, is he just...
He's not in his right state of mind.
Right. Yeah. Or does he recognize that it's her and this is, like, a real thing, but he never would have acted on it outside of it? Not that it doesn't really matter, but when I watched that, I was like, is that real? Is he secretly in love with Dr. Mike?
Right. It is kind of awkward, and I do like how they end this scene, kind of, because I'm happy that Lauren got to see his friend, because originally Lauren was the one that was like, he's on a binge, leave him alone, whatever, this is what he does. Yeah. But to see somebody like that, she's like, if you really want to help your friend, then you'll go to his place and you will drop out every single drop of alcohol that he has, you know, which I think is a good thing. If you really do want to help somebody, then you have to not enable them, but do something about it. And so I really like the acting from all of the characters in that scene.
Mm. Outside the clinic, Matthew comes to talk to Sully. I think Matthew is so mature in this scene where he kind of wants to apologize for Brian.
Right, which I'm happy about.
Yeah, and also just say, like, we weren't, you know, that's not what we were coming to talk to you about. Like, we want you there because we recognize how important you are to Dr. Mike, and we're trying to do something special for her. And to be honest, like, in this scene, I feel like Matthew handles the whole situation so much more maturely than even Sully does, which I guess kind of plays into he's struggling with this right now, which we'll kind of see more of a little bit later. But also, the first thing that he responds to, oh, I know Brian misses his paw, but a man's got to make his own decisions, which... maybe this plays into how Sully's feeling too, but I'm like, I don't for one second think that Brian asked Sully to marry Dr. Mike because he misses his dad. No. I think Brian asked Sully to marry Dr. Mike, A, because he loves Sully to death and has so much respect for him and holds him in such a high regard and just, you know, he's his hero. Second of all, I think he knows that Sully is an important person to Dr. Mike, right? Like, he sees those two things. And that's why I think he asked Sully. I don't think it has anything to do with Ethan Cooper.
Right.
I wonder if that's Sully's, kind of like you talked earlier about Dr. Mike's insecurities and having that pointed out. I wonder if in this moment, Sully's insecurities about being a father figure and comparing himself and also knowing that he never got to be a father to his own child, you know, right. I wonder if that's all playing into this to where he's like, oh, he only asked me because he missed his dad. And then I think Matthew, he's so nice about it because it's not putting pressure on Sully, but it's also... it's holding him accountable to the relationships that he has with this family.
Yeah.
If I was having a party, I would want my best friend to be there. What could possibly be your excuse, you know? I wondered if some people might be like, oh, best friend is code. But I don't think it's code.
No, no.
And so when he ends the thing with, she might find a new best friend, I don't think that's, you better step up or somebody else is going to take. Right, a
thread or something. No.
I think it's more, you know, if you can't be who she thought you were and you're keep, you know, this relationship, then...
she's going to look for it somewhere else, probably.
She's going to have to. And I think Matthew's point is, and that's unfair to both of you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just proud of Matthew in that scene. I'm like, yeah, Matthew, like, he's being so mature and just really...
I agree.
Yeah, it's good.
And it's giving Sully something to think about, even though he might think it's more complicated that, it gives him something to think about.
Oh, yeah, I like that line, too.
Jake is up the next morning in the clinic. I don't know if it's the next morning, but he's awake, and he's saying to Dr. Mike that he feels good, he's ready to go home.
But he's hiding tremors. We saw him, like...
yes, which there's a reason it's called delirium tremens. But Dr. Mike says, like, the alcohol is not... out of your system, which, like I said, it's gonna stay there for a few days. So he promises it's not gonna happen again. I'm not gonna need a reason to drink it because I'm gonna be really careful. I'm gonna sterilize stuff. But she's very adamant about the fact that he can't go home. You can't have a drink to calm your stomach. How can it be possible that you still want what made you sick? And so she locks Jake in his room, and I don't know, I think this is a very good scene because I've seen this before, and I mean, I've worked in the emergency department, and there's been so many times that we've had, you know, you see repeat patients, you see people that are addicted to drugs who want to help themselves but come back in because they're in the same place, or you see their family members or friends bring them in, but they're not willing to change, whether it be alcohol or drugs or whatever it may be. And I think that's a really difficult place to be in. And we see Dr. Mike in this place of like wanting to help him, even if he doesn't want help. But the reality is, if he doesn't want to help himself, then he's never going to get better. And Sully kind of helps her come to this realization because he says you can't force him to do something he's not ready to do. You can't change him. I think that's a hard place to be in. I know it's a hard place to be in. And I think as a provider, at the end of the day, like, you can only do so much. And so she lets him out and she kind of flippantly says, do whatever you want. It's your life, which is, I mean, it is true, right? Like, it's his life. He's going to do whatever he wants. So why put yourself through this where you feel so responsible for somebody's healing and journey and whatever it may be?
Yeah, it's definitely a hard line to walk, especially about people you care about. Well, let me ask you, because when I was watching, the first thing is like, when she locks him in the room, I was like, is that legal?
That's unethical.
Yeah, like, is that, can she do that? It just made me think like, oh, I should ask you, like, what is the procedure in the hospital if you like have a patient come in who really needs help?
Yeah.
And but they say no, like, how much of that do doctors just be like, you're gonna die if I don't help you? Or if someone says I don't want help, do you just let them die? Like,
no, I've seen this in the hospital, and I for some reason I can't think of the name of the paperwork right now. There's paperwork that people can sign, which most times when we see this, it's somebody that's either having suicidal thought or have taken those actions. Let's just say that without going like too in depth and too serious here. With that, there's actually paperwork that the magistrate of the government can sign to admit them against their own will. And I wish I could remember the name of it, but the doctors have to sign that, and it goes through the government where you literally can be admitted against your will and you're not allowed to let you leave. In fact, in the emergency room, we put bracelets on. And if that bracelet gets anywhere near a door exit, an alarm goes off in the hospital. And it happens a lot because you're literally not allowed to leave the hospital if you're under that kind of admission. And so, yeah. So I've seen that mostly with situations like that. I don't really know when it comes to alcohol what the situation would be. I mean, during this time, I'm not really sure.
Yeah, no, I know for this time.
But no, there's a lot of paperwork and legal custody.
So do you just keep them in the hospital until the paperwork gets signed, or are you not allowed to touch them?
Yeah, we keep until some medical professional, usually it's a psychiatrist, when they get admitted to like a mental health floor or something like that, can clear them and say they are not a danger to themselves or others, then they can be discharged. But if they're not to that point, they're not allowed to leave. And again, the magistrate has to sign that paperwork as well. And it's a lot of waiting because, I mean, you know, to fax that off to someone and get it back and have them sign. And it's a big process.
Is there also, like, the doctors are like, you need to stay here, you need help, but they don't have that paperwork from higher up? Do the patients then have to sign, like, you know, they wanted to give me, but I chose not to, so if I die, it's on me?
There's paperwork for that. It's called an AMA, against medical advice. People sign that all the time, whether they don't want to wait in the waiting room or they just don't want to be there anymore. They don't want to take the advice of the doctor. You can leave anytime you want, but usually what happens is a doctor has to explain to you, a doctor or a PA or an NP. I'm advocating for advanced care professionals. But I mean, somebody has to basically tell you what the risks are, tell you what you're willing to do. And then you have to sign a paper saying, because you understand that, you're still choosing to leave against medical advice. Hmm. Yeah. So there's paperwork for that too. And I've seen that a lot of times. Like I said, we have regulars who are just alcoholics who would continually come in. And you know, I think medical staff does a good job trying to advocate for whether it's detox or rehab or whatever, but some people are not willing to do those things or don't have the resources to do them. And I think a lot about the quote that's like, your desire to change must be greater than your desire to stay the same. And I think that's the mentality that happens in today's society, but definitely in this case as well. If his desire is to stay the same is greater than his desire to change, and so that's what he's going to do.
Hmm.
I'm sure I understand more of that one day when I'm actually working in a healthcare setting. For all you guys out there who are, probably know way more than I know, but that's just my little bit of knowledge on that topic. We do have Hank come to the clinic to visit Jake, which is quite shocking to Dr. Mike because, you know, Hank's not the most...
because it's Hank.
Yeah, caring person. And I love Dr. Mike. She's like, yeah. He's like, well, I did come all the way over here. And she's like, it's a really long trip, isn't it? AKA, he walked 10 feet across the street. But mostly it's just weird because Jake is kind of acting out of character. And then we find out that he's there.
He's all dressed up.
Yeah, and then we find out that he's there. You know, she's like, well, if you really want to help Jake, like, I really want to talk to you about that. And then he's like, great, like, I've never seen you smile before. Let's go get some coffee. And you're just like, what is this creeper moment? Like, and then I flash back to the fact that he overheard this, like, first conversation with Colleen and the marriage book and everything. So they do. They walk over to Grace's.
We can say that it's obvious that Jake hasn't had to actually pursue or flirt with a woman in maybe many, many years.
You mean Hank?
Or, yeah, Hank.
I'm like, well, Jake's a little busy at the moment.
No.
You mean Jank?
Jank. It just, yeah, it's the whole thing is weird. And I think that's, it's meant to be a little bit weird. For sure. Because when you see Grace's face.
I love it. I'm like, you're a true friend. That is exactly how you should be. Yes. You know.
And Colleen flipping through the book. There's nothing in here about men.
How
like
did this happen?
Him.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, then there's some comments about there's wild turkey on the menu.
I don't get that. What is that?
I think Grace, what do you mean, what is it? It's exactly what it sounds like. I think I think Grace is trying to make a dig and call him a turkey or something like that. I don't know.
There was a weird pause there. She goes, wild turkey. There was a thing, but I was like, what does that mean?
She's such a good actress. She's so funny. Then it's weird because they're like making small talk and I'm like, I thought you were gonna come over here and tell him how to help his friend, and suddenly they're talking about Boston, and suddenly you're talking about like,
I want him to be like, you hail from the former colonies, like, so you're from Boston, right? I'm like, wait, how long has she been here? Of course you know she's from Boston.
But I bet they haven't. He doesn't show much interest in anything other than himself. True. So it is weird. Yeah. Well, then it gets even weirder because they have this weird like Tarzan Jane hand against each other moment. And I'm like, sure, if you were to tell me I have good hands for stitching up people, I'd be like, thank you very much. But it's just too weird because it's coming from Hank of all people. And sure enough, we get to the conversation in which she says, if you want to help Jake, you need to stop serving him. You're part of the problem. You're part of the reason he got into this.
Again, and Dr. Mike doesn't know how to ease people gently into her opinions.
She just kind of places blame and lets...
She literally says, you're partly responsible, which at this moment, I want to be like, Dr. Mike, which he kind of does, but I'm like, you are also partly responsible, which right. He kind of... But she doesn't set herself up to get people in her corner. And I'm not talking about gross manipulation, because I know there are people like that too, because we've had those snake oil salesmen who can sweet talk their way into convincing you that you stand with them or you stand to benefit from what they want.
Right.
I'm not talking about that, but I'm talking about she literally doesn't know how to ease people into her opinions. She just says, here's what you're doing wrong. Fix it.
Right. And it doesn't go over well because, like you said, then Hank's somebody who will dish it back. And he does. He says, like, you're the one that drove him to drink, which everyone has been thinking. And I mean everyone by, like, viewer-wise.
Yeah.
But nobody said it, you know? But then it turns into this big thing where he's like, anybody, like, putting up with your harping has to be loony. And then he's like, you're man enough for the both of us. And it's just, like, basically, like, dagger words at each other. And you're like, yeah, this is what I was expecting, which is why we were all like, what is going on?
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. I think you make a really good point of saying what he says to her about her also being playing a role in how Jake has progressed. And so I think her lack of compassion or even understanding as a medical person, right? We often don't consider Jake as a medical person, but the fact is before she came there, he was all the town had. And so whether he's been formally educated like her or not, and whether all his methods are right or not, and whether he definitely should have known better about the razor, it is to be said that, yeah, her just throwing the accusation out does not leave her as blameless in the guilt that Jake is feeling, I suppose.
Right.
And we're glad that someone said it.
Right.
And then I guess it's the next day, but it literally feels like moments later because they're in the saloon and Jake is there and Dr. Mike is there and Hank is there, but they're all wearing different clothes. Dr. Mike, I guess, has changed her mind from the whole it's your life because she's like, I'm not gonna let you do this. I like that she's called in for some reinforcements, that the Reverend wants to help Jake too.
Yeah, but then Hank clearly still has a bone to pick because he's like, you gonna let some woman tell you what to do?
No, totally. But then following, he's a walking contradiction, Hank. I cannot figure this man out because then a second later, Jake tries to take the bottle from him and he won't give it to him, you know? So even right. though he was like mad at her for being like cutting him off, like he did do it. So
yeah. But Jake doesn't really want any of them to help. And he runs back to his shop, locks himself in. Then he drinks like this. Well, first off, he looks and realizes there's no alcohol left. But he drinks this like blue thing. And then I'm like, is that supposed to be like their antiseptic? Like, yes. I didn't think there was something, but I don't know what it is. But I will say, I also saw this in the emergency department. People that desperately want alcohol will drink anything. We used to have people like try to get hand sanitizer and drink hand sanitizer because it has ethanol in it. You wouldn't believe how much stuff ethanol is in, and people will do anything to get it if they're really in that state. So it kind of reminded me of that, but he passes out. Before he does, he says, you know, you can't help me, nobody can help me. And I think he feels very hopeless in that moment, even though his friends have tried to do something for him. It's just not clicking in his head that, like, people care about you and they're trying to do something about that.
What's maybe not super clear, which we'll find out in like two scenes from now or whatever, is that he's not just trying to drink himself into not remembering things, but he's actually trying to kill himself here. Which I guess, like, we know from Dr. Mike's perspective, she's like, if you keep doing this, you're gonna die. And I guess he says he, like, doesn't care, but I don't think it struck me until the scene later how much, like, that was the point.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think I was thinking about that a ton either, and that's, I mean, it's a serious thing, it's a sad thing, but I think you're right, actually.
Sully and Cloud Dancing are racing, and they both have the same...
Riding horses, and I bet you like it.
Horses, yes, I loved it, and I like seeing them riding together because it's fun. And this is the only scene we get Cloud Dancing in this episode. But I always get excited when he's there because, I mean, he's kind of the best, right? Speaking of, like, best friends. And, well, he can tell woman troubles.
I love it. I'm like, what a friend. He's like, what you running from? Woman troubles? And then Sully's like, the spirits tell you that?
Yeah. And they've been friends long enough. But I like that Cloud Dancing recognizes it's not a fear of getting close to someone again. It's a fear that he won't be able to love anyone again. You could almost make a whole episode, right? Just on that, of like moving on from love lost. And especially with Sully's story and the tragedy that goes with it. That's scary. Like, not only did Sully love someone and lose his wife and his child in, you know, a really heartbreaking way, but then he kind of pulled out of the world even that went along with that, right? The world of family and the homestead and the town, you know? Like, he really isolated himself from anything that could be familiar to that world that he could have had with Abigail and their baby, and, you know, kind of became this rugged frontiersman and got to know the Cheyenne, and we love that about him. But we recognize that progression of from the Sully that married Abigail to the Sully that we know now, like, are very far apart. the characters or the writers or the actors could have played this as easily as kind of trivial, like, you know, I'll just get back on the horse, man, you know, but like,
right.
Which is kind of ironic because he said, you used to be afraid of riding horses and, or afraid of horses, period. And now look at you, but recognizing like, you know, just because you're afraid of something doesn't mean you give up.
Right. At the Mercantile, Myra and Horace are whispering and they're pretending that they're talking about corn and...
they're bad liars.
Very bad liars. That's like the dumbest thing you could talk about. Well, then Lauren is talking to a customer saying something about, oh, that's who they wanted me to court. And Dr. Mike is like over this, you know? She's like, this is my life and I will be happy if you guys will stay out of it and not talk about me. And before anyone can respond, we see Jake.
Well, I think she's about to go off on them saying, like, you can't tell me how to live my life. And then she realizes it sounds familiar.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, I think she realizes that Jake's watching her and she realizes she's telling people to do exactly what she got mad at him for telling her to do.
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
And so when she goes to talk to him, she's like, you're right. No one has the right to tell you how to run your life, but you need to recognize...
people care about you.
Yeah, we don't want you to die. And he says, like, it's really hard. He's like, I wanted to die because I deserve to die. Because I not only let someone down, but someone died because of me. I appreciate that Dr. Mike admits that she took her anger out on him.
I was thinking a lot about how I was going to totally really not like this episode if she didn't actually apologize, which she never actually says officially, like, I'm sorry, because I think the way that she went about that was wrong. But she does recognize about the fact that you said she was in a very heightened emotional state and she felt the need to go do that. And it was the wrong time, the wrong words. And she did. She took her anger out on him. And so I'm glad she addressed that because I was getting worried when I was rewatching this episode because I couldn't really remember, like...
yeah.
Does she actually say something about that, or is it just, like, dismissed because she's Dr. Quinn and she can get away with whatever she wants, so...
And because I think you could very easily argue, well, she's not wrong. It's more than a mistake. It cost Savannah's life, but...
but she says, you know, we all make mistakes, and one of the hardest parts about that is having to forgive ourselves, which I think is, like, super relatable, even now, like, being able to recognize, like, we're human, and a lot of times it's not even about outer... circumstances, about how we feel about ourselves in that circumstance. And that is one of the hardest things, is giving yourself grace, forgiving yourself for whatever has occurred. And so it's good advice. And even the fact that then she brings up, like, people love you, you have friends. Sully and Lauren were there holding you back. Grace came. Myra was the one that checked on you. The Reverend, me, like, what about me? Even with all our differences, I care about you. All the things that I've tried to do have come from a very good place, and it's a good pep talk.
It's really nice.
It's probably more than a pep
talk. I like that she acknowledges you've done a lot of good for a lot of people. I kind of mentioned earlier, before Dr. Mike got there, Jake was all they had.
Yeah.
The moment that comes forefront to my mind is in A Cowboy's Lullaby, where he helps the sick baby Mike from the tummy ache. And which, because we know that he doesn't really... like indigenous people, but in that moment he saw a baby in need and he stepped up, you know. And so I just think about, we pick on Jake a lot in moments and just be like, he doesn't know what he's doing, he bleeds people out. But at the end of the day, I think for however many years he's been out here doing this, he has really tried to help people. And has he been wrong a lot? Sure. But he's never gone to college. His education is the experiences he's had. And would there probably be more people with a lot more issues without him? Yes. Might there be people who died because he didn't know what he was doing? Yes. Sure. But I don't think you can blame that 100% on him just being mean. It's just maybe him not knowing any better.
Right. Not having the knowledge. I agree. I like what you just said. Finally, we've gotten to the birthday.
The kids are all dressed up. They got a cake. They surprise her. They've glued the china together.
That is so sweet. I love that. I love that they didn't get her, like, some other gift. I think that's the sweetest thing ever.
I love that Brian's like, you cried when it broke. Now you're crying when it's fixed.
He still has stuck in his mind what thinking needs to happen because Dr. Mike...
Oh, the wish.
Yes, Sue tries to make a wish, and he's like, I bet you wish for Sully to marry you. And I love it. Dr. Mike makes this, like, big sigh, and she's like, we need to talk, okay? She more or less explains that, like, family is about people who you love and people loving each other, and that's all a family has to be.
I like the idea that she kind of explains to Brian, like, we are no less of a family simply because I'm not your birth mom and that I'm not married and that your dad isn't in your life. Like, around. That doesn't make us any less of a family. And yeah, that's really special for them, and especially for kids who have grown up in unconventional families. I think that's really important to have that reminder. And I think it plays beautifully into the scene right before where Jake said, I have no one, I don't have any family. And she's like, look at all these people who care about you. That's family. You know, like the two scenes, I think, complement each other well.
They do. They definitely do. More importantly, we get kind of this full circle moment because she says, remember when I said I was lonely? The reality is I'm not lonely and I know that I never will be. So we kind of tie that in from the beginning, which is a nice closing moment.
She's out of that once a month I feel sad about it.
Right. But then Horace shows up and says, Dr. Mike, emergency 911. You need to come.
And apparently she asked no questions on the whole ride to town.
That's true. You think they probably made something up.
No, I'm sure they did, which is part of why I wish they had at least had Dr. Mike go, what's wrong? And then Horace go, I don't know. Lauren told me to get you right away, you know? And then we would have been like, okay, she's just going. But since they don't have that one line, I'm like, did she just not ask a question the whole ride in?
She's a good doctor. I'm sure she did.
We know it is the surprise party.
Surprise party.
She is not too proud to admit, so this is what you're all talking about. You let me make a fool of myself, which I probably would have reacted very similarly because I would have been like, stop talking about me. Grow up. Mind your own business. And then if we had got there and it turned out, I probably would have wanted to shrink into the floor and be like, I probably would have cried.
I would have been like Grace being like, yeah, you look stupid. That was the best part. Watching you make yourself look stupid. Jake's obviously there with some unspiked punch for her, of course. And we have a big unveiling, which is a really, really great gift that the town has given for her, which is a very nice medical sign hanging over the clinic with her name, Dr. McQuayla. What is... I'm, like, making up names this episode. I don't know what is going on, but...
McQuayla. Dr. McQuayla.
It sounds cool. It's Michaela and Quinn together.
Okay, there you guys go. Next fan who has a baby. McQuayla.
McQuayla. It's Michaela Quinn. Yes, and of course, then they're like, speech, speak. And she's like, I'm not one for making speeches. And everyone's like, ha ha, yeah, right, you and your speeches.
Do you want to know the funniest thing? So I was watching this episode, haven't watched in a while, obviously, was watching to prep for the podcast. She says, I'm not really one for making speeches. I pause the episode, because that's what I do when I want to write down notes for myself. I pause the episode. Yeah. I write down in all capital letters, lies. And then I hit play, to which she goes, okay, maybe. I was like, okay, I was about to go back through the episodes and be like, woman, your life is making speeches.
Yes. But she just says, I'm very proud to be a part of this town.
Love.
I want to keep treating everybody, medically treating people for a very long time.
Awesome.
And it's sweet. It's like, she's just the best, right? Because she's like funny, but kind, but appreciative, but just, like, nice to be around. I don't know. Obviously, I like Dr. Quinn, but I bet...
To say that she's proud to be a part of this town that we know has not made it easy for her to be there in the beginning, it's great. And the sign is awesome. And we know for quite a number of episodes, we've still seen the Mrs. Cooper's boarding house sign up there. So that's so thoughtful.
And just the fact that they're recognizing... Once again, she's a doctor. She's a real doctor, and we don't have to write Michael or Mike like it's Michaela. Like, she's a woman, and she's a doctor, and we've come to the point where the town's more okay with it than they were before, and we'll take it.
Yeah, that's true. It's all good. And then...
And then everybody goes to eat.
And she wants to stay and look at the sign.
I feel like I see this in too many TV shows. They're like, go ahead, like, blah, blah, blah. And then, like, you know, that's when a big moment's going to happen. That's never happened to me in my life where I'm like, actually, let me sit here and ponder through my thoughts before I join you all. Maybe I'm just not that.
You're not that girl.
Apparently. But sure enough, Sully shows up and he is very handsome and shaved and he looks very nice.
And he's wearing a suit.
He's wearing a suit.
We've never seen him in anything other than his kind of rugged outdoorsman clothes.
Which I still prefer, but, you know, a man in a nice tailored suit.
And he brushed his hair.
He's shaved. Do you notice he's shaved?
Like, I notice he's shaved, but his hair is brushed.
And she tells him it looks good, and I'm happy she tells him it looks good, because I think if someone looks good, you should tell them they look good. And she says, you look very handsome. When she says it like that, she's like, you look very handsome. Like, she's like timid to say it. I don't know. I'm about to get really weird.
Like I said it already, but I'll say it here. I love the misdirect of him. You think he's gonna have bought this dress for her to, like, dress her up to look pretty, and in the end, he gets dressed up for her thing, and it's such a stark contrast, but he, you know, he kind of says, what, can I get dressed up for a special occasion? For a
special occasion.
And you're like, we honestly didn't know you still had normal people clothes. And then, is Sully's love language gift-giving? Because I think
I think it might be because, you know,
from the Christmas presents that were, like, so thoughtful. And then he gives her a saddlebag that he's made that has special compartments for her medical supplies, like...
Very nice. It's very nice. It's thoughtful. And now we're both avoiding the topic.
And then she kisses his cheek.
And then he kisses her on the mouth.
And then they both look a little, like... Oh, we just did that.
Eek. You know, it's really funny on the website because you're like, Kelly is the more romantic sister. And I'm also like, this is so awkward. Why do we have to talk about this?
Do you think it's an awkward kiss? I don't think
it's not awkward. I'm uncomfortable. They're not awkward. I'm awkward. That's what I mean.
I almost personally don't think, like, the kiss on the lips, I'm like, We've been waiting for that, right? But then he holds her hand when they go to the rest of the party. That's where I'm like, are they dating?
It's cute. I love it, but it's super awkward.
There's no profession here, though.
It should end that way. If there was, I'd be pissed. Let's just say that right now. If there was some sort of like, actually, I'm super in love with you, and no, we should move forward.
I would be like, but I just... Well,
what is he gonna say? I like you, by the way, in case you didn't know. Since I just kissed you.
They both know? They don't have to say anything.
I'm not saying that, but I would be annoyed if it ended that way, and I like it. Let's be honest, like, this happens a lot in real life, where something happens and then people don't talk about it because they're not adults, and they're like, we're not gonna talk about what just happened and what this means for our future. And I'm happy that they don't do it right now because it would have ruined the episode. This is a better way to leave it, and we will catch up with them and their progression in the next episode. It's her birthday. They don't need to ruin it by having a discussion about some, like, define the relationship talk. Okay, Sarah?
Define the relationship. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not saying I didn't like it. I just, it is a choice that has been made. Like you said, I don't know that they need to say anything because... They do, especially if we look at that logical viewing order, the last two episodes have definitely made it clear, like, they are aware of their attraction to each other, of the feelings that they value each other more. And I think it connects to that last conversation where we were like, they're kind of awkward because they start talking about Brian and it's like avoiding, like, where do we stand? And so I think here, this is the first step to being like, okay, let's hold hands and go together, and it's
a way of acknowledging the fact that they care about each other without having to talk about it, which correct. I think that's how best friends should be. They should understand that that's how they feel in the moment, and they shouldn't have to say anything about it. And yeah, and it's her birthday. Like,
it's her birthday. She's 35. She doesn't have much time left. She's gonna die.
Oh my gosh. You just made that rhyme, and if you don't put that in, I will be mad.
That is funny. And that's the end of the episode.
It is a cute ending.
Yes. Favorite scene?
Can I go first or do you want to go first?
I'm asking you. Go.
Matthew and Sully having the conversation about best friend and not making it complicated. When I was watching that scene, I was like, this is going to be my favorite scene. Like, that doesn't happen very often for me. Usually I watch the whole thing, right, and I think through it. But as I was watching that scene, I was like, I loved it.
I could kind of tell the way you were talking about it. I think for me, I'm going to pick two. And what I mean by that is, obviously, I really like the end scene, not just because there's a kiss, but I like them. I like the fact that he tried really hard for her, even though the whole time he, like, played it off like he didn't want people to think he cared that much.
Even though he was being a butt. We haven't said that in a while.
You said it. I like that. I like that they hold hands back to the party. I like that it's just a nice ending to the fact that they care about each other and they don't need words for that. But realistically, outside of the fact that that's cute, I really like the scene where Dr. Mike is outside Jake's room and Sully is talking to her about the fact that, like, you can't get someone to do something they don't want to do. And I think I just liked it because that's something I've had to work through in my own emotions as a healthcare professional working in healthcare, of, like, how do you combine this side of you that wants to be a moral person but also needs to be a human and understand that that's not how the world always works. So I really related to that, and I thought it was good that she had someone like that in her life to be like, this is reality. I know you care about this person, but sometimes caring about someone means letting them know you're here if they want help, but at the end of the day, they have to make their own decisions. So I'd probably pick those two. Now, when it comes to ranking, I will just be right up front. Yep. Say, I really like this episode. Okay. Because it's not like it's just focused on the fact that, like, the kids are trying to find Dr. Mike a husband. It's not just focused on that. I think you have this really serious storyline also that has a ton of, like, cool medical stuff involved. So, of course, I like it. I'm thinking of putting it somewhere high-ish up, but what are your thoughts?
If I break down this episode, good performances in this episode, all the characters, I love where they move all of them in this episode, from Dr. Mike to Jake to even Lauren, you know, kind of how you said he has this subtle storyline of, like, witnessing what Jake's going through, to even some of the funnier ones where when we look at, like, you know, Hank and the Reverend, and those are fun. And then we have, like, good small character moments where, like, you know, Robert E. only has basically that one line, but it's good. You know, mm-hmm. Grace has a little moment. I like all of that. I would definitely watch this episode highly again. So yeah. Then we look at the theme. There's the theme and the message of Sully. Just because you had an ending doesn't mean you can't have a new beginning. We've got Jake learning to ask for help, to forgive himself, to you have people who care about you. You just have to let them in. You can't just lock people out. Right. I think Dr. Mike recognizing... Yeah, the big one of that. As a doctor, she has a lot of responsibility to save people, but that doesn't mean that it's her job to save everyone, right? Like, there has to... She cannot do that alone. She needs people, too. And I think the message for the kids of, like, family is bigger than blood. So, I mean, all of that. Is there another option?
Really? Okay, because let's think about it. Number one is Bad Water. Number two is The Pilot.
Yeah.
Both episodes that I personally really enjoy. Yeah. So are we moving this up to number one? Or do you feel like, oh, Bad Water, The Pilot?
I personally like this one better than Bad Water.
I mean, Sully is more of a butt in that.
He's such a butt.
But there is a lot of... I think that's why I like it. Because I think I'm okay putting it number one. Just because I feel like there's so much progression. And I think everybody loves this episode. Who doesn't love this episode? Even if you only like it for the end, it's still worthy of being liked.
The Dr. Mike and Hank shippers won't like this episode.
Or the Jake and Hank shippers. The jank shippers. I'm here for you as well. So, you heard it here first, folks. Coming in at Not a Lady Podcast episode ranking, number one would be Happy Birthday. That's a big move. I hope people, like, agree.
I didn't anticipate that when we started talking about this episode.
Yeah. I'd like to hear what people's opinion are on that. Let us know, guys.
Yeah. I hope some of you are keeping rankings, too, because I want to know what other people, how they rank them.
If you want to, definitely let us know. We have some social media platforms, which would be Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can find us at Not a Lady Podcast. Also, we have an email that we check very regularly. It is notaladypodcast@gmail.com. And of course, all of our rankings are on our website. That is notaladypodcast.weebly.com. Don't forget, we also will be featuring lessons in our next episode.
I'm excited to see what people pull out of, because there's a lot of characters in this episode and there's a lot of messages. Yeah. So
there's a lot of serious. You could have some serious lessons. You could have funny lessons. You could talk about how awkward we are talking about it, and that would be a great lesson. I will take any criticism or advice on the fact that I know that was weird.
Kelly goes, how to be less awkward.
Let me know.
It's one of my favorite things is talking about your lessons, so do make sure to write in. That being said, our next episode, we will be talking about... Dun, dun, duh! Rite of Passage, which I do remember this one. So... it'll be interesting, especially after how much of a fan I was of Matthew in this episode and how mature I thought he was. He runs with that in the next one.
Yes, he does.
So we look forward to doing that one. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you want to support our podcast, please be sure to like and share our content on social media. And we look forward to talking to you in the next episode.
Till next time, guys.
Bye.